Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm April Wolf. Every week I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about their fave genre film, perhaps one that has influenced their own in some small way. So a reminder that we are remote recording. I'm in my bedroom, very hot, and you might hear a chicken screaming. Chicken is my cat, if you do not know. The audio is going to sound a little different from our studios. Everything else is the same, except for today, our guest is writer, director, Emily Haykins.
Hi, April. Thanks for having me.
For those of you who are unfamiliar with Emily's work, please let me give you an introduction. Emily began her filmmaking career in Texas when she was 12 years old and saw an Australian horror film called Undead that inspired her to write and direct her first feature, the teen zombie film Pathogen, about a waterborne disease that turns a bunch of teens into zombies. That micro-budget indie, chronicled in the documentary Zombie Girl the Movie, put her in the public eye as an up-and-coming wunderkind, and she's followed it up with four more features, including teen vampire satire My Sucky Teen Romance, which premiered at South by Southwest 2011 from Dark Sky Films, coming-of-age Halloween film Grow Up Tony Phillips, which premiered at South by Southwest 2013, and teen heist film Coin Heist from 2017, a Netflix original still available to watch on Netflix. She also wrote and directed the segment Touch in Chiller TV's horror anthology Chilling Visions, Five Senses of Fear, and the segment Cold Open in the horror comedy anthology Scare Package, which is on Shudder right now. She recently completed the six-part teen drama digital series Hold to Your Best Self, which premiered South by Southwest 2018, and the teen horror short First Kiss for Snapchat's VHS series, which had its digital premiere on Halloween 2018 and its theatrical premiere in the Midnight Shorts program at South by Southwest 2019. So, Emily, the movie that you chose to talk about today is The Faculty. Can you give us a little explanation on why this is one of your fave genre films?
Yeah, I watched the movie again last night for the millionth time just to be prepared and psyched up for this. I watched it pretty early on in my interest in genre films, where I was still pretty scared of anything horror, remotely horror related, still scared of even Halloween, even the holiday, you know, just Everything was still freaking me out at this time. But I started to get a little bit of an interest in genre films and wanting to kind of make my own genre film before I made my first feature when I was pretty young. And The Faculty had this really great mixture. Well, my parents showed it to me because of the Austin, Texas connection, and that's where I grew up. And it was a little too scary for me, but they were like, you know, you're interested in filmmaking. This was made in the area. You might be interested in seeing, you know, this movie that was filmed around here. And it just had that right balance of kind of campiness and just genuine horror, and also really great teen characters with agency. And, you know, they're the ones saving the day. They don't rely on the adults. And that's kind of a theme that's resonated with me in my career. So I, even watching it again last night, it just really felt like such an origin of my love of horror and teen horror. I just think it's a great movie.
It's a great one to revisit too, I think. I loved it when I was younger, when I was a teen, and I didn't know until, you know, fairly recently that it wasn't as well received as I thought it was. My bubble, it was like, we all loved it.
Yeah, I didn't know until last night when I was Googling, you know, I wanted to like just do some more research and stuff. And I was like, people didn't like this movie? I didn't even know. Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense. And, you know, I'm very curious as to why Robert Rodriguez did not do an audio commentary track for it, which makes my job a lot harder. But it does make you wonder what the hell happened. But for those of you who haven't seen The Faculty, today's episode will give you some spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. As always, my motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause and watch The Faculty first, this is your shot. And now let me introduce The Faculty with a quick synopsis. Written by Kevin Williamson and directed by Robert Rodriguez for release in 1998, The Faculty stars an ensemble cast of young stars, including Josh Hartnett as Stoner Zeke, Clea DuVall as Goth Stokely, Elijah Wood as Nerd Casey, Jordana Brewster as popular girl Delilah, Sean Hitosi as Jock Stan, and Laura Harris as virginal new girl Mary Beth. In the first moments of the movie, we meet Bebe Neuwirth's Principal Drake, who informs the teachers that the budget is low and music and art, all that stuff, is going to be cut. But football gets everything that they want.
This is a football town, let me remind you. And yes, the team will get new jerseys and new knee pads and new jock straps and anything else they want in the name of education, because that is what the school board wants. Because that is what the parents in this town want. I'm sorry.
Then Coach Willis, played by Robert Patrick, stabs her in the hand with a pencil, and the teachers eerily hunt her down and kill her. The next day, it's a regular high school day, with Zeke selling his homemade drugs, Casey getting his nuts knocked into the flagpole, Stan questioning if football is good for him, etc. And Principal Drake is there and seems to be fine. Casey goes out to the football field and finds a strange slug-like creature. He brings it to a science teacher who says it's a kind of parasite.
I don't recognize its surface tissue at all. Casey, I don't want to blow smoke up your butt here, but I think you found a new species.
Casey and Delilah, in the interest of the news business, hide out in the teacher's lounge to try to get a story. But they instead find a teacher's dead body and Coach Willis forcing a parasite creature into the school's nurse ear. They call the police, but a strangely confident and smug and very alive Principal Drake says they're just making it up to get attention.
I can see how it all got out of hand. It's a pretty bizarre series of events.
The next day, Casey comes up with a theory that an alien species is taking over the school.
We think aliens are taking over our school.
Look, you saw what Brummel did in the shower.
I saw a dead body in the closet.
And they've been calling the students into the office all day. The students with the most influence on down, including the new team captain.
Looks like you picked the right week to quit football.
You think aliens have infested our school?
That would explain their weird behavior, wouldn't it?
Give me a fucking break.
Everyone laughs at him until the science teacher suddenly gets very aggressive. Zeke cuts off the teacher's fingers, which keep moving, and then Zeke stabs the teacher with a pen full of his designer drug and kills him. The drug, apparently, really dehydrates people. All the teens take Zeke's drug to prove they're human, but Delilah doesn't pass and destroys Zeke's lab before escaping.
There's nowhere to go. Nowhere to hide. We're everywhere.
Stokely says there's probably an alien queen that needs to be killed, and they think it's Principal Drake.
We kill the queen. We can get them all back.
But when they kill her, nothing happens. Meanwhile, the football team is infecting opposing players with the parasite. Stan gets turned by Coach Willis. Zeke gets accosted by his hot alien teacher. And Stokely gets the surprise of a lifetime when Mary Beth reveals herself to be the alien queen.
You know, in my world, Casey, there were limitless oceans as far as the eye could see. Beautiful home till it started to dry up. So I escaped. Came here. I met you. All of you. All of you were different from the others. You were lost and lonely, just like me. And I thought that maybe I could give you a taste of my world. A world without anger, without fear, without attitude. Where the underachiever goes home at night to parents who care. The jock can be smart. Ugly duckling beautiful, and the class wuss doesn't have to live in terror.
Stokely gets infected, and Casey and Zeke go ahead to head with Mary Beth, whom Casey lures behind the bleachers, then crushes with is like some kind of thing. Like, he just crushes her. And then he injects her with the drugs. A month later, everything is back to normal, with the teens paired up romantically, having saved the world from an alien invasion. But it's maybe not as happy ending as you think. And that's the end. Okay. So, this is a Kevin Williamson film, is how it was billed. It was not billed as a Robert Rodriguez film, as an Elijah Wood film, as a Josh Hartnett film. These were not stars. So, it was Kevin Williamson who was very much the lead of this, and that was because of the success of Scream. And for him, though, he was so excited that Robert Rodriguez was going to be doing his script because, you know, he'd already worked with Wes Craven and he just kind of appreciate these directors who bring new things to it. And he said, quote, "When I was watching the movie for the first time, I couldn't believe the energy Robert approached this with. It's different from a lot of his other stuff. It's true the camera's always moving, it's fast, a lot of the things he's known for, but he gave the camera a restlessness. You always feel like it's moving in an unnerving way, which is exactly the characters I created. He truly understood what I was trying to do with the voice of the kids, and he visually transposed that," end quote. Which, I mean, maybe I'm trying to figure out why Robert Rodriguez wouldn't want to be talking about this film all the time, considering that people are like refinding these movies from the 90s. But maybe it's because it wasn't specifically a him movie.
Right.
You know, it was a Kevin Williamson movie.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I was kind of looking into that last night and kind of how Kevin Williamson became the kind of visionary for the project through Miramax in the wake of Scream. Because I think it was a story created by some other writers that was taken by Miramax. Yeah,
exactly.
And kind of revamped mm-hmm. with Kevin Williamson's style. And Robert Rodriguez was coming off of, was it Desperado or From Dusk Till Dawn? These movies
From Dusk Till Dawn,
they kind of
yeah.
had this fun quality to them. And it just felt like, What a perfect match at that time in both Robert Rodriguez's career and Kevin Williamson's career. I mean, in my mind, I haven't seen a single Kevin Williamson thing I have not just loved. I just mm-hmm. watched Dawson's Creek, and it's very new to me as a fresh, oh my gosh, this is amazing, but it is not new to anybody else. I talk about it all the time. People are like, this is old, shut up, you know. But
yeah, you're living in the past, Emily.
Yeah, it's interesting. I do wonder, you know, what maybe if it's Robert Rodriguez or the studio, I don't know.
I think the thing that I'm really interested in is the fact that he was able to kind of like accommodate this other voice, that Rodriguez was able to take his own style and adapt it to this other person who was clearly the kind of like dominant presence in this particular kind of storytelling that he was doing. And, you know, I think that he and Quentin Tarantino, when they were working together, they have kind of like a similar style, or at least they did. You know, it was probably very easy to transpose those words into image. But I think that it's like just the sign of a really versatile director that they can take this other material and make it work. What are your thoughts on that? Because you tend to write your own work, right? Like you're generating most of your own work. Have you thought about taking on other projects that are maybe a challenge to your own visual style?
Oh yeah, definitely. I tend to write because I mostly see the writing as a blueprint for what I already have in my mind as a visual. I guess sometimes, especially in independent filmmaking, you encounter people that don't really read the actions in the script. They mostly read the dialogue. And so I mostly mm-hmm. just come up with a plan for how I'm going to direct it. And I don't really focus too much on the actions themselves. If I know it's something I'll be making, because I'm just like, well, no one's going to read that anyway. but I appreciate reading a really good script, and I'm always, always open to directing someone else's work in a collaborative effort, because collaboration is one of my favorite things about making movies to begin with. That's why I don't want to just be a writer. I want to work with actors that mm-hmm. bring characters to life, and cinematographers that bring a unique vision to the story. And I guess the closest I've come with that is I made a movie for Netflix called Coin Heist that was based on an existing work, a young adult novel. And I had to, yeah. I did write the screenplay for that, but it's based on some existing property. So that was a translation process from book to script. The screen.
Does that, do you think that like expands your kind of visual vocabulary, being able to do that?
Yeah, I'd love to do it again. It was really interesting because that property as well originated as a script that got turned into a book, that got turned into my script again, that got turned into a film. So that particular property went through a whole kind of like telephone game of what that story actually was. And it was kind of interesting mm-hmm. to me, because in a sense it almost felt like nobody's story. I mean, like everyone kind of took their own approach with it, and in fact I never even got to read the very original iteration of it as the script. I only read the book version, and mm-hmm. and then, you know, I wrote something based on that. But it kind of shows how an idea can be translated through several different perspectives. And I mostly, in my version of it, tried to focus on things that are important to me, mostly teenagers having, you know, I kind of brought this up with the faculty, but teenagers having agency in their own journeys and learning from their mistakes and consequences. And those are themes that really resonate with me. And so I kind of tried to lift that out of the story a little bit more and focus on that with the performers. And I guess that's kind of going deviating from the original question, but I would love to work with other people's material more often, because I feel like, you know, if it is somebody's original work, if you're working with somebody's, you know, novel that they, though it's very, you know, personal to them, I would love to work on turning that into a screen adaptation.
So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk more the faculty and more of Emily's history of amazing work. We'll be right back.
Hey, J. Keith.
Hey, Helen. Hey, you've got another true-false quiz for me?
Yep. Our trivia podcast, Go Fact Yourself, used to be in front of a live audience.
True. Turns out that's not so safe anymore.
Correct. Next. Unfortunately, this means we can no longer record the show.
False. The show still comes out every first and third Friday of the month.
Correct. Finally, we still have great celebrity guests answering trivia about things they love on every episode of Go Fact Yourself.
Definitely true.
And for bonus points, name some of them.
Recently, we've had Ophira Eisenberg, plus tons of surprise experts like Yardley Smith and Suzanne Summers.
Perfect score.
Woo-hoo.
You can hear Go Fact Yourself every first and third Friday of the month with all the great guests and trivia that we've always had. And if you don't listen, well, then you can go fact yourself.
That's the name of our podcast.
Correct.
Woo.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Emily Higgins, and we are talking about the faculty. So something that, you know, Emily, you may have been noticing in your revisit of so much media from the 90s is this really ever-present cynicism that is in so much of the work, but particularly genre film of that time, and particularly genre film that was trying to appeal to teens or younger audiences. And this is something that Kevin Williamson was very purposefully doing in his work, because he kind of understood a very key thing that I think a lot of people had missed when it came to teens of the 90s. He said, quote, "When you're telling a scary story in this day and age, you can't tell a story in 1998 and not comment on things in a cynical fashion. We live in a cynical time. It's also hard to get an audience to believe something unless you let them laugh at it. So trying to get someone to believe in something they've seen 100 times before is very hard unless you give them the ability to go, wink, wink, we're laughing because we know this is a movie. We know we're making fun of this. The situation is ironic. And maybe if you can fool them with the humor, you can build to a place that can actually scare them," end quote. And I mean, case in point, Scream is the big one, but I think he's also doing it here. He was doing it even with his movie Teaching Mrs. Tingle, which he directed himself. He was doing it in Dawson's Creek. There's an irony in those, a knowing and an understanding that the teen characters are actually smart. They're not just kind of dumb, silly 1980s, like, let's go see what's in the closet kind of thing. They have a different intelligence in them that is reflected on the screen. And I was wondering about, you know, what do you think of cynicism? What do you think about, like, having to try to scare people? Like, is it possible to still scare people in a genuine way without kind of lulling them into this false security? Or
that's a really interesting point, because I was just reading an article about the faculty and cynicism last night, and it was pointing out things that I had never noticed before, and I read it before I watched the movie last night, and I was able to kind of pick up on these things I wasn't noticing, including the ending, which I guess I'd never noticed the obvious cynicism in in what was intended with the very final images and what Elijah Wood says and what happens with the flagpole. I have to say it went over my head when I was 12 years old.
Oh, really?
Now, yeah. Of course, now it's, you know, I'm like, how did I never see this? But I think that, you know, that's interesting. I generally in my writing and my philosophy in horror, I don't know if I could write anything cynical. I don't think I view things in a cynical way. So I'm not sure if that's something that I could bring to the table with my horror. I kind of tend to say I want to see light character, not light necessarily, but hopeful, optimistic, something light to hold on to in our protagonists, make their way through a dark world, through some dark situations around them, and see how that gets challenged and shaped through the dark circumstances. And that's mostly the view I take when I write horror. But I really like that quote about cynicism and kind of, you know, getting kind of like weaseling your way into someone's minds and what they think they know and subverting it with a cynical perspective. And I think the faculty does that very well in ways that I never noticed on a million rewatches until doing some thorough research.
It's an interesting thing in terms of generational aesthetics, too, because it is a very 90s aesthetic that we're talking about, that cynicism that's like specifically from the 90s and doesn't always apply elsewhere. I mean, I think a lot of people made a big deal about the fact that millennials became a kind of generation of positivity, of like all good vibes, essentially. Just like, and that was a thing that has been appealing to people of a certain age, you know, for a long time, is like a little bit less cynicism and a little bit more kind of activity or earnestness. And earnestness is a, you know, a big thing that I think I saw within most genres, that it kind of made a comeback and cynicism died out. And now I think that we might be in the new cynicism meets earnestness generation, where we're trying to pound those two together and see if they can potentially work.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think that especially with how technology has shaped us, and has shaped young people now, especially when you're writing for young people now, there's mm-hmm. a lot of I just feel like the way that information is processed, as somebody who grew up with Facebook, you know, it's just really strange. You know, you grew up getting text messages versus phone calls, and that just changes how you process the world mm-hmm. around you. And it's very odd. And now, you know, when you can really, really tell, I mean, I think you could always tell, but you could really, really tell when a middle-aged white guy is writing young women for TV or film, because they absolutely did not grow up in the environment, especially in the age of technology. But, mm-hmm. I mean, everyone had technology, but I'm just speaking specifically to social media and kind of text messages. And I just feel like that really kind of shaped your brain. And even, you know, since I graduated high school in 2011, the kids now, I do not understand. I don't know what TikTok is. I don't know what I don't know what else they're doing. I did something for Snapchat. I told them I don't really know what Snapchat is. They were okay. Still, we made a good, you know, agreement there. But it's still like I don't feel, you know, as connected even now. And I'm not 30 yet, you know, and I just feel like things are rapidly changing in how young people are growing up and perceiving the world. And the moral of the story is, I don't think old white guys should be writing that, especially for young female protagonists.
Yeah, I mean, Kevin Williamson at that time, I think he was like definitely a, you know, like this anomalous figure of like earning this right to kind of capture teen voices. And but he's a rarity, I think. But
right.
I want to go back into something that was also part of that quote, and it has to do with humor. And we've talked about this a lot in the show. This comes up quite a bit. A lot of people who need to kind of put humor next to horror, humor next to sci-fi, to feel comfortable with it, to make it feel comfortable to be afraid. But it has to be a certain kind of humor. And the way that Kevin Williamson said was, quote, humor is so important. As long as it's true humor, situational humor and character humor, and not just campy derivative humor, end quote. So I think that he was kind of thinking about maybe timeless humor, things that don't rely on like a certain kind of like pop culture like reference or something like that, that was just, you know, has nothing to do with a character, but it's just like a buzz of like, oh yeah, here's an in joke for the time. Here's some camp. This is fun. Make fun of this. And so I like the fact that he's all about like not making fun of the characters, but having the characters make fun of each other. You know, like it's a weird fine line that he's writing.
Yeah. I'm definitely a big believer in that philosophy in comedy and horror comedy in general. I love horror comedy. It's my favorite genre to work in. I felt really lucky to get to do a segment of Scare Package, which just came out on Shudder, because it was an opportunity to work in that genre blend. And it's also just hard to convince people that it always works, because horror and comedy are both a little subjective, and sometimes it could be a little more comedy horror. But I really think, since both genres have a setup and punchline kind of quality to telling a good scare or a good joke, I think that they really do work really well together. And yeah. I just really think that the comedy that people remember is that really can like stick with their hearts is something that resonates on a character level, or just the perfect unfolding of a situation where you can almost see it, you know, coming. You can see the kind of how the joke might unfold, or it's just, you know, perfectly tied into the situation. I can rarely think of a joke I've seen in a, you know, Hollywood comedy movie that's just, you know, something that's funny of the moment that really sticks with me. Maybe it's like a chuckle then, but it's not. I think tying comedy to characters and the situation and the plot is the preferential way to go to just make a good movie, to tell a good story, to have a good character arc. And that's really my philosophy working in comedy or horror comedy.
I'd love to go a little bit into casting for this film. Because the faculty, despite the fact that they said they had no names for the cast, has a ton of fucking names. It is like from the adults being like Bebe Neuwirth, Jon Stewart, Salma Hayek, like the list goes on and on and on. And then the teen cast is just like, those people are all still bankable stars. And this is before, I think Elijah Wood was the biggest name. And that was because, you know, he had been a child actor. But this is like pre Lord of the Rings and his kind of like ultra fame. You know, this is like him still kind of working off of like his earlier, like North and the Good Son and that kind of thing. So it was apparently a really, really arduous task of pulling this cast together. Robert Rodriguez said, "I never thought I could juggle that many characters. Speaking parts alone, casting took forever. It took longer to cast than to shoot. It took months. It's an ensemble group, and once you cast one person, you'll change your mind who you want for the other parts because of who you want to work together, not just for the students, but for the teachers as well." And that's the end quote. And I think you can kind of see it, because there were so many different kind of pairings that needed to work and needed to kind of like vibe off of one another. And I mean, apparently, you know, they came up with the best case scenario, but still, it was apparently taking much longer to cast than it was to shoot.
Yeah. I think that really paid off in the performances are just, they're great. You know, every person I think shines in what they're trying to do. And, you know, knowing kind of the twists and of the film and just how intentional the dialogue is, how much foreshadowing goes on in the first act of the movie, and just how subtle every performer, I mean, it's not a subtle movie at times, you know, but the performers are able to work with, I guess that balance of being able to, you know, people that may not be human anymore, giving a subtle look at times, you know, or, you know, but the dialogue could be a little, maybe on the page could read a little bit heightened, but they ground it really well. And I think it's that combination of that really skilled writing and these really great actors, even the young actors, you know, just really making it the chemistry work and really investing your heart into the what happens to them.
You know, it's an interesting thing too, because the audition process involved going in, taping for Rodriguez again and again. They had multiple callbacks. All of them had multiple callbacks because they had to keep kind of moving pieces around, essentially. And so you would think that it would be you know, these people come and know exactly who their characters are when they get to set. But because of all of these kind of rearranging pieces, they were still kind of figuring it out as they went along. And Robert Rodriguez called it the kind of like half knowing. He said, quote, when an actor comes to me or a crew member and he goes, I'm not sure I know how to play this part. I go, that's beautiful because the other half's going to show up when you're here. They say knowing's half the battle. I think the most important part is the other part, not knowing what's going to happen, but you trust that it will be there when you put the brush to the canvas. It's going to know where to go. And the further you're out of the way of it, it'll just happen, end quote. And for him, I think that it was nice to have these younger actors a little bit destabilized by the casting process to be like kind of fully in these awkward teen years and kind of finding the magic in the moment, which is, you know, half terrifying and half exhilarating, I'm sure.
And that's very true to the teen experience because you're really flying by the seat of your pants as a teenager. You don't know what you're doing. And yes. I think that's why I think that's why I'd really gravitate towards young characters in storytelling, because I just think that time in your life where you don't know what you're doing and you don't know who you are is kind of just a really interesting headspace to occupy, and to just get those really authentic moments, I think you do have to be unsure of yourself as a performer, which must be really difficult. I cannot imagine acting, let alone being in that position, especially mm-hmm. in those self-conscious teen years. But it's really, I just, everyone really brings it in the movie. There's no, in my opinion, no bad actors. The first person that comes to mind when I say that is Usher. I just love that Usher is in the Faculty. I think he's great.
I mean, that was a funny thing.
Usher included.
Yeah. Yeah, the marketing of that film was like Usher. It looked like Usher was the star of the movie. yeah. He was not. Yeah. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk more of The Faculty and a bunch of Emily's movies. We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Dan McCoy.
I'm Stuart Wellington.
And I'm Elliot Kalin. Together, we're The Flophouse,
a podcast where we watch a bad movie and then talk about it.
Movies like Space Hobos, Into the Outer Reaches of the Unknown and the Things That We Don't Know, the movie, and also Who's That Grandma?
Zazzle Zippers, Breakdown 2, and Backhanded Compliment.
Elvis is a Policeman.
Baby Crocodile and the Happy Twins.
Leftover Potatoes?
Station Wagon 3.
Herbie Goes to Hell.
New episodes available every other Saturday.
Available at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bye. Bye.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Emily Higgins, and we're talking The Faculty. So something that I really wanted to get into is the fact that when I think of the 90s in filmmaking and stylistic choices, I do think of Robert Rodriguez, even today. I think that he holds true on very specific stylistic choices, and he almost waits until they come back around into style because they're like kind of hip now or they're different. And one of those things was something that was kind of like adorably out of fashion by the time it was used in 1998. And that was the introduction of characters with a freeze frame and the character's name flashing on the screen as a title card.
Yes. And
it's such a shortcut in filmmaking. And I think that, you know, like the economy of that, of just being like, here's the character's name, remember who this is lovely. And it is, like I said, very economical because you have so many fucking characters to deal with that it's just like, it's so nice to the audience to just be like, this is who it is. Moving on. And it also sets up a kind of kitschiness to it, a tone of silliness in a sense that like, hey, the sci-fi story might give you a little bit of the creeps, but it will also be endearing to you.
Yes. Yeah. I think maybe that's a good example of that. The movie is endearing. Like there's nothing about it that's trying to be ironic, I feel like, or, I don't know the word. Just like, it's not really trying to, it kind of has B movie elements, but it's not trying to make fun of horror, like say that horror is stupid or something like that. Not that kind of B movie, but like it has campiness to it that is genuine. And I think that the title sequence is a good example of that. When I think of that tactic, I think of The Faculty because the font is just so burned into my brain in the red, you know, letters. And I just think it is great for an ensemble, especially a teen ensemble, because there's a lot of like little background players that are kind of talking, like the couple arguing, and that's just all kind of going on during that opening credit sequence. But mm-hmm. I think that there's just something like, it's just earnest through and through, from every decision, even ones that are a little wacky like that opening credit. I love it. You said it and it made me smile. Yeah, it's great.
There's almost something that I noticed about this too, that Robert Rodriguez almost approaches the big set pieces as their own kind of like distinct short films, in a sense. Like if I think about the opening of the teachers attacking the principal, it's an encapsulated thing. It could exist unto itself and has its own kind of visual sense and visual style. And then you go into this kind of these character introductions and it has its own sense of style. And then going on, and each one almost feels like it was inspired by like a different sci-fi movie of the past or a different movie of the past, you know?
Yeah. I feel like too, the amount of, the visual choices being made for each scene, it kind of shows something that I wish there was more of now, I guess. I feel like there's a lot of like TV is really cinematic these days and movies are more like TV. Like it's just kind of this thing mm-hmm. visually, I guess, where just especially when it comes to things like camera movements and color palettes, I just feel like I would just like to see more cinematic choices, like just the way the opening of The Faculty, not saying everything should be The Faculty, but you know, just how different the opening is from, you know, the very opening with the principal. Yeah, you're right. Mm-hmm. You're exactly right. It's a completely different visual style. That part scared the daylights out of me when I was a kid. That was the part, the opening with the principal getting stabbed in the hand, because it's darker. It's it doesn't have this kind of like youthful energy to that sequence. It's just kind of straight up scary to me. Mm-hmm. It was and then you start to meet the kids and it becomes a little bit more like fun and goofy at times, and as the situation gets more scary it's a little less goofy. But I just want to see more I guess horror, teen horror now, that has those visual tactics in it.
Yeah, just a thoughtfulness to those things. I wanted to talk about working with a budget after not working with one for a very long time. And because this is a movie where everyone came in and it was a well-oiled machine. Robert Rodriguez had worked with this crew for a very long time. And, you know, his now ex-wife, Elizabeth Avalon, was the producer on it. And it felt like a family, apparently. And everyone was like, you know, specifically doing one job, as opposed to, you know, like what a lot of people who had worked on independent film who started working on this film said, was that they were happy that they only had to do one job, the one job, as opposed to doing everything all at once. You know, like yes. Group is also filling as like craft table. And what Laura Harris, who played Mary Beth, said is, quote, "It was the first non-independent movie that I ever worked on. So the feeling of money, you know, the catering, it was like a little less frenzied. Everyone really stayed within the confines of their job. Everything was fulfilled. Like on an independent film, everyone's doing a bunch of jobs at once. And this was like, there's a person to do every single little thing. It added to the ease of working with Robert Rodriguez, to the flow. It just flowed very easily. There were no problems, just the attitude on set of grace and ease," end quote. And, I think it's really interesting, like when I hear about movies that have big budgets, you know, a lot of big budgets, and things seem like they're a mess. It's just like, oh no, you don't have the right person, you know, steering the ship. Because if you do have the money, I mean, like, that's finally the luxury. Like, that's the thing. Like, wow, everyone has to do their job and that's all that they have to do. And, you know, taking that stress away, like, that's what money should be able to do.
Yeah, exactly. It sometimes it adds more stress where it shouldn't. But that's kind of what I think you dream of from making really independent films, to just being able to pay people that you love to work with that are really talented and dedicated. Mm-hmm. You know, you just say, oh, I want to be able to pay you more than what I'm paying you, or, you know, put you in a nice hotel if we have to shoot at, not in, you know, just something that's not leaking from the ceiling, you know, just like, not like the Ritz or whatever.
Yeah, not something where you're like the worried.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Just like, so everybody, you know, so the money is used to like show people, just everybody on your whole crew and team, how much that you value them and their hard work. And, you know, I don't know. That's always what I hope for with the next film and the next film. It's, I just want to show people that how much I love to collaborate with them and how much, you know, we value having them on the team and what they bring to the project. And that is a pitfall of really independent filmmaking, because you might be working someone a little long, or they might have to pick up an extra job, or the food might not be as good, and you still are trying to tell them, but I promise you, like, I love working with you. I will just write you a really nice thank you note this time, you know? And but it is, you know, Robert Rodriguez really symbolized kind of moving from extremely independent filmmaking to working with studios in Austin, where I grew up. And that was really influential to people like me that, you know, we're growing up in Austin and wanting to make movies, and to see how other people in the area were able to do that was really inspiring, especially when I, you know, I also loved Spy Kids, separate conversation. I saw it a thousand times.
Great movie.
Theater.
Yeah.
But I just thought it was, I had like gotten pretty far in some Spy Kids contest where I invented something, and I just thought, this is the height of my career and with the best movie ever made. And I was like, this is amazing. But then it led into, oh, he made, you know, From Dusk Till Dawn. And as I started to get interested in horror, so interesting that he has this very, you know, diverse filmography. Someone who grew up as a kid interested in filmmaking, leading into an interest in genre filmmaking in Austin.
Yeah. Well, as we end this episode, I'm going to end us on a lovely Rodriguez quote to take us out. He said, quote, "You always feel like you're still in high school. I used to make movies instead of papers in high school, and I'd get graded on them. It's the same thing with this movie. I turn in my movie project and wait for my report card from all the teachers. A-, B+, C-, thumbs up, thumbs down. It's kind of cool. It's like you're forever a student in this life. I can't wait to see what I get on my report card," end quote. So... it's That's a lovely, lovely sentiment. And I want to thank you so much for joining us today and talking about the faculty in all of your films and your career. And again, people can see, they can see The Coin Heist on Netflix. And where else can they see your work right now?
Yeah, I have a short on Snapchat, which you have to watch on Snapchat, called First Kiss. And then Grow Up Tony Phillips, another one of my films, is out there on streaming platforms, and that's, I think that's all I have available publicly right now. Oh, wait, wonderful. Sorry, Scare Package just came out on Shudder. Sorry, my bad.
Yes, so take a look at all those, get familiar with Emily's work, and then you can watch The Faculty. And thank you again so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you would like to tell us what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. And please check out our Facebook group too. That's facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
Give me a fucking break.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.